After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
It can feel to us as though we're failing personally if we're anxious. When I think of my 18-year-old self, I felt like I'm a mess. Like, why am I like this? Like, and as though it's my personal fault that I'm depressed or I'm anxious or I'm struggling to just be focused and not be distracted all the time. But it's our biology, it's the world, it's completely predictable why we respond in these ways. The question is, what are we gonna do about it?
Hey everyone, Raghu back with Mind Rolling and Cortland Dahl. Cortland, namaste. Nice to see you.
Wonderful to see you. Great to be with you.
So I first met Cortland, who is, you'll have to do some corrections here, but executive director of Mingyur Rinpoche's foundation, correct? Which is called?
Tergar International.
Tergar, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So I did a podcast with him. They were doing some kind of program. That was a delight. And I thought I just wanted to spend a little bit more time with you. So
yeah, here we had a great discussion.
Yeah. It was really great. But you know what? I didn't, now that I'm doing this with you and did a little bit more homework than I might have done last time, I am like a bit blown away by what you have done. I mean, Cortland has translated some intense Tibetan text. Okay, let's start there. We're going to talk about that. And of course, his involvement with Tergar and Mingyur Rinpoche. And what's the other major output that you have?
Yeah, so I have sort of my life is divided between my work with Mingyur Rinpoche and Tergar on the one hand, and then I'm also very involved with the Center for Healthy Minds, which is an interdisciplinary research center at the University of Wisconsin in Madison.
Uh-huh. Right. And that you're living near there, right?
Yeah. Yep. I live in Madison.
Right. Anyhow, I just, as I said, you know, I was going through and looking at all the different things, and not just that, but 8 years living in Tibetan refugee settlements in India and Nepal, and never mind just being able to hang out with Mingyur Rinpoche. By the way, people, if you've listened to Mind Rolling before, I've done a couple of, I was fortunate to get together with him for a couple of podcasts that are really worthwhile listening to. Actually, I did it with Krishnas, who's also a major, you know, we consider ourselves to be students of his. So wait, we got to go back here now. You're a kid, you know, and you're getting into teenagerhood. What dawned on you that there was, I always say the same thing because it's what happened to me, that there's a path to happiness?
Yeah, well, I'd love to say that I was just some spiritual prodigy or savant and having some amazing insights or something, but the reality is I was wound very tight. You know, I was a curious but pretty anxious kid. And in particular, I had a lot of social anxiety. And one of the things that used to completely throw me into a total emotional tailspin is public speaking. So it's ironic that I do so much public speaking now. But just to give you a sense of how intense it was, when I was in high school, I believe, I got so wound up being on stage. This was like a choir thing or something at high school. I literally fainted. I passed out cold, face down. Oh, no. And not only that, my mom like ran down the aisle and leapt onto the stage. It's fortunate that I was unconscious for that happening, because it would have been way worse. Yeah, exactly. As a high school student, that's not, you know, we'll just say my coolness factor did not exactly go up that week. So I was wound really tight. Yeah, I kind of as a kid, and I got to college, and the kind of low grade social anxiety of my high school years kind of went through the roof, and I was just not in a good place. I was really overwhelmed by meeting new friends and starting over at a new school and all the stuff, just all the stresses of being in college. But that turned out to be a real blessing in disguise, because it got me looking. You know, it got me curious about what I could do to work with my mind and emotions. And as luck would have it, I've always been a reader, kind of a voracious reader. So I stumbled upon some books on meditation at the time. And I've always been kind of fanatic about whatever I do. So that just got me started in a lifelong journey. And I knew, I would say within a year, within 6 months of meditating regularly, that I had discovered something that was going to define my life. And in many ways it has. I had no idea where it would lead, but it really, meditation has been at the center of my life ever since.
Mm. Wow. It wasn't a big dose of acid, right?
Well, there was a little bit of that mixed in somewhere along the way too, but probably that there was a lot of things, probably more the anxiety than anything else. But
I had the combo. I had the anxiety, depression, teenagerhood. I was saved by music, actually. Particularly, my big story is as a kid being somehow ushered into a club where John Coltrane was playing with his quartet in Montreal, where I'm from. And I absolutely had my first, it wasn't my first, but I didn't realize it at the time, out of body experience. I mean, you know, I just was gone. And so between him and Dylan, I kind of, okay, I got assuage. I'm not the only one that's completely, you know, anxiety ridden. And, you know, then a little bit of psychedelic. And then I met Ram Dass. So, you know, that was my combo.
What a journey. Yeah. Coltrane and Ram Dass and a little bit of acid mixed in, and something's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So how did you meet Rinpoche? That's personally, you know, that my favorite thing is people's stories of being with these kind of beings.
Well, let's see. So I started meditating. That's, you know, this is the early 90s, you know, 93 or something, that, you know, those, that time in college when I started meditating. And from there, I got interested in psychology and science at the same time. So I was working in a lab. We were studying intelligence, actually. And so at that time, I thought I would go into grad school and study psychology. But my father, and probably what was for sure the best gift I've ever received, gave me the means to just backpack after college. And I went to Asia. I had already done a study abroad trip to Asia, so I'd already traveled there a little bit. And I went at the beginning kind of almost like a tourist, just kind of running around and seeing all the sights. And at a certain point, got very bored of that. And decided I just wanted to really practice and meditate. So I was doing a lot of yoga, a lot of meditation, just going different places. I'd stay for 2 or 3 weeks and just, you know, practice. And I was probably the most solitary backpacker in history. I had no interest in like the social part of it. I was very much on my own.
You weren't going to Kulu Valley and smoking charas with the sun.
No, I wasn't. I was on my own with a big pile of books. In fact, I think I had more books in my backpack than clothing or anything else. It was just lugging a bunch of books and reading and meditating. So let's see. I went, you know, that was a turning point for me, because I went back after that period of traveling. I went to Naropa University and did a master's degree in Buddhist studies. And that's where I first connected with the Tibetan tradition. I met Dzogchen Punlop Rinpoche and Kempo Tsultum Gyatso Rinpoche, two great Tibetan masters. And I had been really, I would say, turned off, to be totally honest, by the Tibetan tradition. I was always drawn to like the more Zen simplicity than all of the, you know, the imagery and everything I saw in the Tibetan, the Tibetan world. But they were just so impressive as people. I just couldn't, I mean, it was probably like when you met Ram Dass, it's just like, I don't know what's going on with these people, but there was something different in a really, really inspiring way about being with them and being around them that it opened me up to that tradition. And I thought, okay, there's clearly something I don't understand here. So I'll lean in a bit and see what there is to learn. So from there, I finished that master's degree. And again, I thought I would go into more academic work, do a PhD. And I went over to Asia. I went back to Asia. And I thought I would learn Tibetan for a year. And then I would go back to grad school again. And I ended up, as you mentioned earlier, I ended up staying for 8 years living in Kathmandu and, you know, living in Tibetan refugee settlements. And that's where I met Mingyur Rinpoche. And there's a whole story to that. But I met him in about 2000. So, you know, now 23 years ago when I was living in Kathmandu and really learning Tibetan at the time and doing retreat, which has always been my main passion. It's just deep practice. Mm.
Okay. What's the story? You met Rinpoche, Mingyur. By the way, everybody, just to give some kind of context, a number of years ago, I mean, this is someone who's young. I mean, Mingyur, what is it, mid-40s at this point?
Yeah, he's probably 40s. I think he's 46, maybe right now.
Yeah. And, but he comes from a lineage of a family, the most extraordinary family. All of them. I mean, the father, Tulku Urgyen Rinpoche, was one of the great meditation masters of the last century. There's a wonderful book. Every time Mingyur comes up and we talk about it, I always say, you've got to get this book. He wrote an autobiography, Tulku Urgyen, called Blazing
Splendor.
Splendor. That's it.
Weird title, but it is. It's an amazing book. It's like, just old stories of old Tibet, and it's just amazing.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Anyhow, he had three sons, four sons, one who just passed, I think, last year.
Yes.
Choki Nima, Tsokni, and Mingyur, and they're all extraordinary teachers. I mean, they are so elemental to the zeitgeist of the transference of Tibetan knowledge into a context that we Westerners can understand. Hopefully we'll get enough time to talk about a little bit of something I've been reading of Tsokni, who did a book with a good friend, Daniel Goleman. You may know Danny, probably.
Yep, I know.
Because of Richie, yeah. And so he took off about six, seven years ago, out of his monastery. He was the head of a couple of monasteries, and he didn't tell anybody except his father, and he just, boom, took off in India with a few shekels, rupees rather, and went through several years of extraordinary, where he was not the honored abbot of a monastery. He was just a regular, he turned himself into a sadhu begging for his food and so on. So he did die and, you know, he had an NDE because of a terrible dysentery that he got. Anyhow, this is he's somebody really special. And there's the context for your story.
Yeah, thank you. So yeah, it's true. So Mingyur Rinpoche is, I'm far from being the most unbiased person, but he's one of the great living masters of the Tibetan tradition. And so he's, as you said, he's in his mid-40s now. When I met him, this is around 2000, so he was quite young. We're almost the same age, so we were both in our early 20s at the time. I was living in Kathmandu. In fact, I had just moved there. I had studied Tibetan in Darjeeling, India for a while, and then I moved to Kathmandu largely because another teacher who I had met and was studying with, another great, great master named Chöpfö Rinpoche, who is one of the kind of the towering figures of last century. So I went there basically to be around him and to spend time with him. But he was in his 90s, in his mid-90s. He ended up passing away a few years ago, well over 100. Mm. And so he wasn't very actively teaching And when I met Mingyi Rinpoche, it was like meeting a young Trapa Rinpoche. I mean, it was like meeting just, you know, just one of these great living meditation masters. And the circumstances of our meeting were quite, I would say, quite unexpected. And so I had moved there and I was living on next to nothing. You know, I had rented a room on this little dusty dirt road, and I was sleeping on a blue foam mat in a sleeping bag. And I had a desk that I bought for $5, you know, and it was just, you know, living like literally on next to nothing. And the place I stayed didn't have any hot water. And it can get quite cold in the winter. There's no heat, and it's, you know, so it can get a little cold. And there was a Hyatt hotel that had just opened this, you know, in the area where I was living. And for, I think, like $20 or $30 US dollars, you could get a membership to their like gym and their spa. So basically, I would go there and I would take a hot shower because it was like the only place where I could go and decompress. And so as luck would have it, one day I was there and I had never heard of Mingyi Rinpoche. I literally had never even heard the name Mingyi Rinpoche. He was not really teaching. And I mean, he'd maybe taught a few times, but he wasn't certainly a well-known teacher at that time. But his brother, Tsoknyi Rinpoche, who you just mentioned, was pretty well-known. And he had been teaching and had a following in the West. And I had met him, but I had been to a night, a teaching he gave one time. So I had been in the room with him and seen him. So I was actually, it's so strange to say, like a place you meet your, you know, your main teacher. I was in the steam bath at the Hyatt Hotel and I'm just sitting there by myself. Nobody else is there. Wow. And suddenly two Tibetan guys walk in and I had no way of knowing they were even lamas or monks or anything because they were just wearing towels, right? They were just two Tibetan guys who walked in. I kind of recognized Tsoknyi Rinpoche. He looked familiar, even though I'd only met him or seen him once. But the other, Mingyi Rinpoche, at that time, I didn't recognize him at all. And so I was trying to figure out who they were. And I didn't want to just come out and say, hey, are you Tsoknyi Rinpoche? So I said something like, I think I maybe asked him his name. And he gave me, Tibetans all have like 50 different names. So he gave me some other name, not that he didn't say Tsoknyi Rinpoche, said something else. I think it was Gyurmei Dorje or something he said. And then I said, okay, that's not helpful. And then I said, you know, what is your lineage? Like, what's your lineage of Tibetan Buddhism? And then he said, Drukpa Kagyu. And I realized, actually, I don't know Tsoknyi Rinpoche's lineage at the time. So that didn't help either, even though he told me.
Yeah, right.
And then, so I couldn't quite get a handle on if it was him or not. And then he asked me some questions. He said, oh, what are you doing? And I said, oh, I'm studying at Shukinima Rinpoche's monastery nearby, which again is one of the other brothers that you know. So this is basically their half brother. And then he looked at me, he did the sign of like, ooh, you know, Shukinima Rinpoche is a little, you know, maybe not all there, you know, a little crazy or something.
Really? Oh.
Yeah, he actually said that. And he was like, he was smiling and joking. And I thought, okay, only a little brother could say that, you know, about a very high esteemed lama. I mean, nobody other than a brother would talk about Shukinima Rinpoche. So then I realized it must be Tsoknyi Rinpoche. But still, I had no idea who Mingyi Rinpoche was. And he didn't say much. He was very quiet. Tsoknyi Rinpoche is very gregarious and outgoing. So he was talking that whole time and had a whole, you know, long conversation with him and he kind of laughing and joking. So that went on and they left and I didn't connect at all. I didn't have any some heart opening moment or anything like that. That first encounter. So fast forward like 3 or 4 months later, somebody had put up a newsletter on the wall of this monastery. And I was, as I said, I was studying at, they had a kind of a Buddhist studies courses you could take at this monastery. And there's a bulletin board. And I still remember the hallway and where it was. And on that bulletin board, somebody put up a newsletter. And in the newsletter, it had a picture of Mingyi Rinpoche. And it had, you know, a page of a bio of him. And it talked about how he had done years and years of retreat. You know, in his early years, he did a, by the time he was 20 years old, he had already done almost 10 years of retreat. So just amazing upbringing. And it just an extraordinary life he had, even though he was in his early 20s, just those 20 years were quite extraordinary. And I just immediately felt I want to study with this teacher. This is exactly who I've been looking for. And I can't believe I was in the room with him and I didn't realize it. And on the spot, I just started making these aspirations, like, may I study with him in this life? May I have the good fortune to meet him again? And I just kind of in my mind went on and on. And I felt like this kind of moment of devotion, I guess you could say. And the very next day, I went back to that same place, the Hyatt again, and you know, to go and to warm up a bit in the cold winter. And Mingyi Rinpoche was there, sitting on the bench in the locker room of the Hyatt Hotel alone. Oh. And it was just, it was just astounding to walk in. And I had been going there regularly, of course, had not seen him in that time. And to, as far as I know, I've never known him to go there before, or other than that, those two times, I've never known him to spend time there because he has a monastery on the other side of the...
God is real, as they say in song.
Yeah, exactly. It was just, for me, I was just floored to run into him right then. Wow. And I've been studying closely with him and, you know, working with him in some ways ever since.
By the way, everybody, one thing I did not mention about, I mean, this is not somebody who came in free. Oh, and none of us come in free. I mean, there's rare examples of that, you know, of siddhas that, you know, don't have that thing going on. No more us and them. But he came in and he was dealing with anxiety, which maybe that attracted you because of your own experience in that way. And his father helped him through meditation to really, and perspective, not just meditation, and perspective. That he's been sharing ever since then with his students. So, yeah.
Yeah, that definitely attracted me. I mean, he talks openly about his, I mean, and as you said, he had anxiety and panic attacks from the time he was a young kid, and he talks very openly about it. And that's not common in Tibetan culture to speak so openly, especially for a high lama, as he is, with a huge international following. And I know for me and many, many other people, you know, it just opens the door to just being human. And he teaches a lot about meditation and the path of awakening, kind of using his own examples of how he worked with his own mind and emotions, which is profoundly helpful and human.
Yeah. Can you share just a couple of anecdotes of being with him and in the way that truth was presented to you for your own transformational process?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. You know, when I met him, so I, as I said, I met him around the year 2000. I started meditating in the early 1990s, and I was pretty, you know, intensive about it. I was doing retreats, even though I had no idea what I was doing. I was trying to do my own solitary meditation retreats. In fact, where I am right now, I'm at my family for generations has had a cabin up in northern Minnesota in the Boundary Waters. I think my great-great-grandfather bought an island in the Great Depression for like $400 or something like that. So we've had this really special remote place. And, you know, so I started doing retreats up here where I'm now, and it's just a very special place. And I had no idea what I was doing, but I was drawn to this idea of kind of deep meditation practice. And when I met Rinpoche, it wasn't as though I was, you know, I had a sort of a false confidence. You know, I kind of felt like I knew what I was doing. I was reading all these books, but I didn't really have a teacher. And I had met some teachers, but I wasn't studying, you know, directly under their guidance, other than just going to a few retreats here and there. But I still remember the very first time I received teachings from him, it was as though he just cleared away all the cobwebs in my mind, all the misunderstanding and misconceptions about meditation and the spiritual path that I didn't even know I had. And I think a lot of it was seeing how much I was wrestling with my mind and had an adversarial relationship with my own inner experience. And there was a revelation to me that all of these things I was resisting and fighting, like just having too many thoughts, or even something simple like, you know, meditating or being in retreat and getting really sleepy, but fighting that experience. Or certainly my own emotions, like the anxiety that, you know, I had early on in my practice. And he had this way of just showing that the practice is not in the absence of those experiences or just trying overcoming them, but really by embracing them and exploring them that you come to experience, you know, these the nature of mind or these this kind of the spaciousness and openness of our being is within those experiences, not when we can finally get rid of all of our inner demons. It's by kind of leaning into all of that. And that was just a revelation to me. And the practical side of that, of just step by step, how do you actually begin to shift experience so we're not just constantly in this tug of war with our mind, emotions, and with the world. And part of it was his teaching. He has a unique gift. You know, different teachers have their own different styles, and, you know, they're kind of each have their own special sauce, so to speak. And his, I would say, is he's a master of the path of really just, it's so clear. Here's the step to take. Here's what you need to do right now. Here's that step to take. And then also, I think, confidence of this sense of it's here. It's right here. You just need to look. You just need to know how to open up to it. And it's right here waiting for you. Not this, like there's just this endless process that maybe after 20 lifetimes, you'll figure it out. But like, no, it's right here. It's right now. And here's how you can just take a simple step to see it for yourself. Mm-hmm. So that to me, I feel like was so profound. The other thing I would say, and I've seen this, you know, I've been very fortunate to spend time with him, not just receiving teachings and being on retreats, but behind the scenes, you know, working with him, you know, for years now. And it's just extraordinary that he is just the most even person. I mean, just if you have ever watched a video or been to a retreat with him and you see him, he's funny, he's light, but has this, you know, kind of profound simplicity of his teachings. And he's literally like that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, like seeing that that person on the stage is that's how he always is. And he's just seeing the world through the lens of Buddha nature. And just seeing that in small ways and large ways, you know, when nobody's looking, that that's how he is. And it's just so inspiring to be around somebody like that, who's just been so steeped in the tradition that it's just who they are all the time. So yeah, it's been a great gift to get to know him and spend time with him.
Fortunate, yes. Good karmas. I met, again through a podcast, Zawichi Rinpoche. Do you know him? Zo Rinpoche?
No, I don't.
Oh, he's phenomenal. He's just one, a very jovial monk who has, you know, this great perspective on not taking yourself too seriously. And his mantra is, don't struggle against the struggle. You'll be fine.
That's great.
Yeah. Now, okay, so you learned Tibetan in order and became a translator. I mean, you know, we do stuff with Bob Thurman, who I'm sure you know, Bob. And, you know, he tells me when I first met him, yeah, no, in a month or two, some crazy thing he learned Tibetan, you know. I mean, how long did it take you?
I'm the opposite of that. I know people who are savants with languages. Yeah. And for me, it was pure brute force. Oh, God. So it's, you know, it's funny because I have spent a lot of time translating these ancient texts, and I never had any aspiration to do that. I feel like my life has been a series of accidents, and I don't know, for whatever reason, I'm just not one of these people who's had a lot of, you know, oh, this is what I'm going to do with my life, and this is what I want to do. It's I think a lot of my path has just been staying open to whatever's in front of me in that moment, and just trusting, and it's led all these really weird, unexpected places. So learning Tibetan and translating was one of them. As I said, I had no interest or no aspiration to do that. When I went to Naropa, it was this master's degree in Buddhist studies that I mentioned earlier in the discussion. They had a few different paths within the degree program. One of them was a language path. The other one, I think, was a contemplative studies, where you could learn about other contemplative traditions besides Buddhism. And I kind of thought, well, you know, Tibetan language, that sounds kind of cool. Like, I've never really learned languages. I wasn't a language person. You know, I kind of like failed out of Spanish in high school. You know, I was not, at all like a language. I was the opposite of a language savant, but it more sounded cool. I thought, oh, I'll learn Tibetan. I don't know. That sounds kind of funky. I'll try that. So I did that. I took, you know, 2 years of just, you know, kind of college level Tibetan. And frankly, I didn't learn that much. I learned grammar, I would say, well, in those years, not because any fault of the training, but there's only so much you can learn, you know, from a few hours a week, you know, taking classes and not being immersed. And then when I went over there, when I went after I finished that degree and I went over to Asia, to India and Nepal, then I thought I would study Tibet deeper, not again because I was going to be a translator, but because to do PhD level academic work in Buddhist studies, you basically need to learn these languages. And so I thought I would study, you know, further my study. So I went there and, you know, I wish I was Bob Thurman and picked it up in a month. But I learned, yeah. I met some people. And actually the first thing I did, which I would say was a rare moment of intelligence on my behalf, a lot of trial and error. But one thing I actually did that was relatively smart is I talked to people who had been there a long time. And I saw that there was a few people who seemed to be very fluent in Tibetan and were translating or, you know, at least had just gotten fluent. And there was a lot of other people who had been there for years and weren't, and really had learned a little Tibetan, but it, you know, had never gotten to the point where they were fluent. And I asked the people that really had become fluent what they did. And the common theme, not surprisingly, was that they had completely immersed themselves, you know, in the Tibetan world. Whereas a lot of the other people, they were hanging out with other, you know, kind of expats who had come from Europe or from the, you know, US or Canada or whatever. And, you know, that was fine, but they just weren't learning Tibetan that fast because they just weren't immersed. And so I just got fanatic about it. I mean, I was kind of famous in the area in a not good way because I literally was like walking around like with note cards, like flashcards, memorizing Tibetan words constantly, like all time. Like I picked up a Tibetan book, like a really well-known Tibetan text that's available in English called The Jewel Ornament of Liberation. That's kind of one of these classical Tibetan texts. But I had the Tibetan and I literally took the first word and memorized it and then just started memorizing every single word in the text until there were no words left, basically until I just knew every word. And as you might imagine, that was not quick or easy, but I was just really
understanding what it meant as well, right?
Yeah, I would take the word. What I was doing is I would write down the word in Tibetan on like on a little note card, and then I would write a sentence that had the word in it, like underneath. Wow. So I kind of had the context. And then I would look up, of course, the meaning of the word in a Tibetan dictionary, like a Tibetan English dictionary. And then I was memorizing those, and it was probably an extremely inefficient way to learn the language. So, but I did that, and I was just hanging out. I wasn't. I'm not a social person by nature, so I was not hanging out. You know, I didn't make many friends, and the people I knew were Tibetan, and I was hanging out with Tibetans, and yeah. So I learned Tibetan, and again, I was not thinking about translating, but I had met Chatur Rinpoche, this other really amazing master. And he didn't speak any English. He didn't have other non-Tibetans around him. So to learn from him, I had to learn Tibetan. To receive any meditation instructions, I had to learn to speak Tibetan. So I met him and then I just studied my butt off. And I think it was about 7 months of really hardcore study before I could really understand teachings, Dharma teachings. And then I went back to him and started, you know, learning, receiving teachings and, you know, started doing retreat and practicing under his guidance.
Amazing, man. Wow. So then you went and you've translated a number of books, but this one caught my eye. Distinguishing phenomena from their intrinsic nature. Holy Jesus.
That's a mouthful, yeah.
Yeah, but
yeah, you know, yeah.
In it is this story, which... Let me preface it a little bit. The other, I did a podcast the other day, over the last couple of days, with somebody who it was a reflection on His Holiness Dalai Lama and Greta Thunberg around what's going on with climate and environment. Incredible book, actually. Anyhow, I was saying to her, I got to say, I am, you know, I'm probably archetypical in that. For instance, I saw an article, this is just a few days ago, in the New York Times about a group of whales, I think off Australia, that formed a heart.
Oh, I saw that. That was amazing.
And came into shore to die, but formed a heart first. And I said to her, I couldn't, as soon as I saw what it was, I just shined it on. I couldn't open to the suffering. It was just, and I said, I'm certainly archetypical. She ended up doing a beautiful meditation about the, you know, eco-anxiety, basically, and how to work through it and more make friends with it. And anyhow, in this book that you translated, I don't know if you want to tell the story, but it's a Sangha and the story with Maitreya Buddha, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Same thing, except somebody, I mean, do you want to quickly tell the story?
Yeah, yeah, I'd be happy to. So so Asanga is one of the towering figures of the Buddhist philosophical tradition. You know, it's basically Asanga and Nirvarjana, you know, are kind of revered as like the two greatest thinkers of the Buddhist tradition. And Asanga in particular, I mean, of course, they're both realized, you know, thought to be realized, you know, awakened Buddhas. But Asanga in particular is kind of the yogi, you know, and represents sort of like the yogic side of the tradition. And this text that you mentioned, there's five texts that come from Asanga and his interactions with Maitreya, like the kind of the iconic future Buddha Maitreya. And so I worked with, you know, with some friends and colleagues on translating these texts. So as the story goes, the Asanga was a meditator and just went and was meditating in the caves and doing kind of very devotional practices, and is said basically to, there's a whole long story, Mel, I'll kind of say the abbreviated version. But basically he's meditating and meditating on Maitreya, you know, doing kind of a devotional practice, but he's not getting anywhere. You know, it's just like, it feels like he's, you know, banging his head on a wall and he's meditating, but there's just no sense of connecting with Maitreya. And, so he keeps practicing and keeps practicing. And kind of the root of the story is that Maitreya was there all along, and he just, his mind was not pure enough to see Maitreya. And kind of the deeper meaning, I think you could say, is about our Buddha nature. You know, it's that we're not seeing our Buddha nature, and his Buddha nature was there all along. And he was only seeing the impurities, you know, the seeming impurities of his mind, and was not tapping into that Buddha nature. So the way the story is told is, you know, he's meditating and meditating and not seeing Maitreya. And then finally, you know, kind of grows despondent and, you know, tries, sort of leaves his practice behind a number of times and kind of goes back and back and forth and back and forth. And finally, has a sort of breakthrough moment. And again, there's all sorts of trials and tribulation in the middle of this. But it's said that finally sees Maitreya face to face and kind of can't believe it. And at the first, he only sees an old dog. This is kind of like the iconic, or the kind of the famous part of the story. He comes across this sort of old dog that's like wounded and rotting and kind of maggots. And he's overcome with compassion. And he just sees, of course, this old dog, nothing to do with Maitreya or anything. But he's overcome with compassion, and he wants to help the dog, but then he realizes, oh, I can't help the dog because it's infected with it's infested with maggots. But also, I don't want to hurt the maggots; they too are living creatures, so I don't want to like take them off and kill the maggots. So he sees that the only way he's going to be able to do that is to take them off with his tongue, which of course you can only imagine.
That one got me. Because I've seen this in India, and I'm sure you have as well.
Yeah, exactly. You can kind of imagine he's closing his eyes, and he's slowly kind of, you know, putting his face near this kind of, you know, sick dog, and then finally, you know, right as his tongue's about to reach the dog, he doesn't, and he kind of hits the dirt and he looks up, and then suddenly Maitreya is there before him. And as the story goes, it's like basically that was like the last impurity of his karma that he purified in that moment of great compassion that kind of broke through, and he sees Maitreya face to face. And again, I think you could see at a more metaphorical level that he finally came face to face with his own Buddha nature, or the nature of his own mind. And then that it goes on, and as the story goes, the Maitreya essentially took him to the pure Buddha realms and teaches him and gives him all these teachings. And these great texts, including the one that you mentioned, were basically the teachings that he received directly from Maitreya and wrote down, and they became these masterpieces of Buddhist literature, of philosophical literature. Those were some of the first books that I translated with some colleagues.
But to me, the biggest point of the story, and why I wanted you to share it, is about the transformation happened through compassionate action, service, basically.
Yes, exactly.
And doesn't that speak volumes? And then I look at myself, not even be able to look at those whales, you know, and then I read this. This all happened within the last few days. So I was just like, you know, I was having to do the Jack Kornfield exercise. It's okay. We're just human, you know, not to beat myself to death in any way about not even be able to open into the spaciousness of the moment around this, which is happening, and it's happening in extraordinary ways day to day for us. That really speaks to us, you know, compassionate action needs to happen. And what is His Holiness? He coined something with Dan Harris. I think Dan Harris, you know, the guy does 1-7% happier, 10% happier, 7%. Wise selfishness.
Wise selfishness. Yeah. I was with Dan Harris and the team when that happened. There was a collaboration that we did for the Center for Healthy Minds with 10% Happier, and this course with Richie Davidson and Dan Harris and the Dalai Lama. And I thought that term wise selfishness, it was such an interesting way to look at it. It
seems so right on, right, Cortland? Yeah. I mean, you know, if what motivates you, I mean, we are all motivated by self-interest is one thing. Compassionate action is another thing. I think we all have that within us. Maybe there's some of us on this planet that are maybe not quite there yet, shall we say, that are taking these horrible actions these days. Absolutely. Whatever propels one to even think in my experience and in my mind, at the moment that you reach out to somebody, just the action like Asanga did, just to look, be aware and want to do something about it and then create an action around it, you stop thinking about yourself. That's wise selfishness, right? Because what are we doing all day long? I'm doing a book with Duncan Trussell, another good friend, podcaster, actually got us at Love Serve Remember into podcasting. He had been doing it for years. He's an amazing guy. And we're doing something called From the Movie of Me to the Movie of We, and using ourselves as examples about how the conditioning and the habitual patterns created and reinforced the separation and so on and so forth. And fortunately, we have Ram Dass and a couple of things we did with him. And the big, you know, the big transformation is about compassionate action. That allows one to really make that jump out of that me all day long, 24/7 thing. So, yeah. So that's what the story speaks to me.
Yeah, it's I totally agree.
Of course, you got to be a Sangha, I'm sorry to say, to be able to even think you're going to go, never mind licking the damn things off. You have to be a Sangha.
But it's true. I mean, if you look at the story as just, you know, the narrative the Buddhist tradition tells to itself, and what it's saying, it's quite interesting, because it's not only that moment of great compassion and the action that he's actually, it's not just him sitting in a cave feeling compassionate, like he's out on a road literally helping a wounded dying dog. I mean, he's the most kind of, you know, in your face kind of experience. Mm. But it's also the backdrop of that is him meditating for years in a cave. And it's, the story is not saying, you know, he meditated for 10 years in a cave and had this moment of awakening. He's saying he meditated for 10 years in a cave and then went out and did something. And that final moment, it was that final moment. It's not saying that all those years in the cave were not important. And they're, of course, led him to that moment. But it's just interesting that that's the story the tradition's telling, that it's culminating in really profound, meaningful action in the world, motivated by compassion. And you can see that with great masters. You know, the Dalai Lama, of course, is the greatest example of this. And, you know, even Mingyi Rinpoche, you know, of course, all this retreat, but they're profoundly engaged with the world and engaged with the suffering of the world and just tirelessly working, you know, like it's nobody's business, you know, just out there on the front lines, helping however they can. It's quite extraordinary.
Well, his book is called In Love with the World, right? Am I right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Great book, everybody. And we'll have that in the show notes as well. So Tsoknyi Rinpoche, so he did this Why We Meditate book with Danny Goleman. I don't know if you're aware of it.
Yeah,
it's quite great. But let's talk about, you know, in terms of, you know, I like to help us all, people who listen to this podcast and the Be Here Now Network, with tips to be able to just apply day to day that are not some highfalutin philosophy, esoteric kind of a thing. And so I thought this would be something we could talk about. Insight. This is, first of all, the insight meditation practice that Jack, Joseph, and Sharon brought back from the East. And we all got involved with it when we were living in India with Neem Karoli Baba back in the early 70s. He didn't say, to him, it was just a good way to kick us out. Go to the course, he'd say. It was like a fun thing, which it wasn't. It was really hard work, you know. But it provided the basis for which insight could happen in us related to inner inquiry and Buddha mind, basically, even though we weren't thinking in those terms back then. But one of the things that Tsoknyi talks about, the key issue in the practice of insight is understanding reification. And I, of course, knew the word, but I never kind of had it in this context, you know, the tendency to make things more concrete or realer than they actually naturally are. Reifying is like believing a dream is real. I think this is an important concept for people. Can you get it down to our day-to-day in terms of making people, us all, understand a little of what that really, the effect of it and how to transform it?
Yeah. Oh, that's a fascinating one. You know, I think in essence, what our minds are often doing is taking a reality and experience that is fluid and open and ungraspable and trying to make it solid, trying to kind of get a handle on it, to make it something that we could, that the conceptual mind can understand. And, you know, it's taking, in a way, it makes a lot of sense. I'll kind of maybe reference some of my, the sort of the scientific side of my life here, as well as the more Buddhist and Dharmic side, because I think there's a very simple reason or part of the reason why this happens, which is that we did not evolve as human beings to be happy or enlightened. We evolved to survive. Our biology and even the wiring of our brain is really good at surviving. It's not necessarily good at being happy, much less being awakened. If it was, you know, we would have, that would happen automatically for everybody, but it doesn't. And I think there's, you know, if you kind of just imagine what life has been like for most of, over the course of human history, and you just imagine a distant ancestor who's, you know, might have spent their day out in a forest foraging for food, and what basically needed to happen to ensure our survival as a species. One of the things that you know, often was happening is there might be some threatening situation. Maybe there's a wild animal, say, you encounter when you're out foraging that day. And then you go back that night, and what's going to happen is your mind is going to play that over and over and over again. So the next time you're out there, you are never going to forget. And the moment you hear that rustling in the bushes, you are out of there, right? If you forget that, you know, and if you just imagine there's 100 people and 50 of them, you know, are really good at remembering that, and 50 of them forget it, guess who survived? You know, the next generation, the people who passed on their genes, they're the ones who were lying in bed ruminating about the bear that, you know, almost ate them that day. But now we're not in the forest, right? We're not, you know, we're not foraging for food. We're in an office, or, you know, we're in, you know, a Zoom meeting or texting or listening to podcasts and the news. But that same biological wiring is getting activated. You know, and so it's this, just this inner narrative, which again is at one point in human history was a great survival mechanism, but now they're emotional threats. They're not existential threats. They're not physical threats, or most of the time, of course, for some people, some of the time that's true. But most of the time, our biological machinery is getting activated, but it's, you know, it's somebody said something unkind to us, or we felt disrespected, or we felt hurt, or whatever, but it's that same fight or flight response in the body that gets mobilized, but there's nowhere to run, you know, and there's no benefit to freezing, but we, you know, we're responding the same way. So I think I mentioned this simply because I think it can feel to us as though we're failing personally if we're anxious. When I think of my 18-year-old self, I felt like I'm a mess. Like, why am I like this? Like, and as though it's my personal fault that I'm depressed or I'm anxious or you know, I'm struggling to just be focused and not be distracted all the time. But it's our biology, it's the world, it's completely predictable why we respond in these ways. The question is, what are we going to do about it? Because that's the bad news, is our biology is just built that way. The good news is that our biology is also built to learn and grow, and to kind of go back to this point about insight. We are insight machines. We are processing so much information all the time, and we are constantly learning. Like, our brains, our minds are constantly taking in just vast quantities of information. And without us even hardly even noticing, we're just constantly processing this and learning and adapting. And so in the spiritual traditions, a lot of what they've learned is how to tap that potential and that learning insight energy machine that we all have in our minds, our hearts, our bodies, our brains. And just to channel that towards kind of undoing this sort of the knots and the rigidities in our mind. This is kind of the reification. It's like the narrative mind, which again can help us survive and helps us in circumstances, just turn that in a new direction. So we're exploring, instead of ruminating about our stressful day, we're exploring the dynamics of our inner experience. And we just start to discover things that were always there, but we just hadn't seen, you know, the narrative and the conditioning just hadn't, you know, been directed in that way. So that's the cool thing. And again, just to bring in another really cool scientific finding, you've mentioned Richie Davidson, this scientist who I work very closely with at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And one of the findings actually was Mingyur Rinpoche was one of the subjects.
First one, right?
One of the very, very first subjects of this, like one of the first studies that was published in a really rigorous mainstream scientific journal. And one of the things was very much on this topic of insight. There's in the brain, there's a kind of a level of activity that scientists refer to as gamma oscillations, which is basically when the brain, different parts of the brain are operating in synchrony, kind of in harmony with one another, vibrating at the same level, so to speak. And normally this happens in just a flash. It'll be like a flash of gamma activity. For example, when you figure out a problem, like if you've got a really difficult problem you're trying to solve, and then suddenly it's like, ah, that's it. In that aha moment, there'll be a flash of gamma, but it'll be a flash and then it's gone. And what they found in that early research was that Mingyur Rinpoche and other advanced meditators were able to induce moments of insight, or they were able to induce levels of gamma activity and then sustain it over time for levels that had never before been seen in humans. Mm-hmm. So it's like you can just induce that aha. I mean, what is it even like to live in an aha moment, to have that be like your baseline rather than a few milliseconds that you experienced 10 years ago?
Yeah.
So anyways, there's a lot to say about that, but it's just fascinating.
And by the way, what I understood with when Richie Davidson did that, those first experiments with meditation and particularly with Mingyur, I understood what happened was they said, okay, so now think of compassion. And they were going to then measure, all the circuitry that was going on. And I think they said, or he said, that usually it would take somebody, even a practiced monk, there was some time involved where the manifestation of the state that they had asked, spoken to, which in this case was compassion, took some time. Mingyur Rinpoche, boom, they looked up, boom, the whole thing burst into this, into this extraordinary display.
There's all sorts of funny kind of stories about that. The, one of the two maybe things worth mentioning, one kind of very similar to what you just mentioned, is that normally with neuroscientific research, it takes a lot of, what we call statistical analysis. I mean, you just get vast quantities of data, and then you got to go, do all sorts of complex computations and analyses. And then at the end of that, you'll be able to draw out a finding of like, okay, this is what we learned from that. But it's not as though you just see it visibly, like when you're looking at the scanner as it's actively happening. It's not visible to the naked eye, so to speak. But in this case, it was like the findings were so dramatic that they could literally see it as they were watching the data come in. So much so that they actually thought the machines were broken. They were like checking the connections, like in a movie, like,
really?
Is this plugged in right? Like there's something seems to be off here. Another interesting thing too, to go back to the point you were mentioning about compassion, is that what they had these advanced meditators do, they were, I think, almost entirely monks who had done, I think, an average of like 30,000 hours of meditation practice. So these are not casual meditators by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. But they first had them do what we call nature of mind practice, or the exact term they were using was open presence. And which is, for those familiar with the tradition, it's kind of resting in the nature of mind, just resting in open, effortless awareness. And that had a signal, but not as strong as what came next. That what they then asked them to do next was another very advanced form of practice called non-referential compassion. That's a very wonky term, but it's basically a form of compassion meditation. Normally, when you do compassion meditation, you might imagine somebody who's suffering and imagine feeling like wanting to help them, maybe even imagine helping them or repeating phrases of compassion. But there's a sense of like, I'm here feeling compassion for this person over there, or for this group of people, or even for all beings. But there's a sense of me feeling compassion for you or all of you. Non-referential compassion is like open space permeated with love. It's like you're resting in the groundless open space of our being, something that few of us even have access to and can touch into, and then just letting compassion and love just permeate this feeling of vast openness. And that's the practice that had the strongest signal of insight. Was that it was really a mixture of insight and compassion and love all mixed together. And that's what has had the really, in some ways, the most powerful finding we've had in all of the research over these years.
That's so great. Of course, Neem Karoli Baba said to us one day, love is more powerful than electricity. You know that, right? Oh, boy. Well, Cortland, really appreciate hanging out here. This time just flew by. We'd need quite a few more podcasts to really get into a bunch more stuff, which if you're open, I will call on you from time to time for us to get together.
I'd love to. Yeah. I just looked at the clock. I'm like, wow, was that an hour? That went fast.
Yeah, exactly. It's so great. So everybody out there listening, Turgar, and we're, what's the website? Is it turgar.org?
Yeah, there's two things that people are interested in learning more. So turgar.org, TERGAR.org is Mingyur Rinpoche's community that I'm quite involved with. And Mingyur Rinpoche, who we've been talking about, is the guiding teacher. And then the other side, the scientific side, is the Center for Healthy Minds. And we've created an app called the Healthy Minds Program. If people are interested more in the fusion of meditation and scientific insights, the kind of stuff we've been talking about, there's a lot of that available in the Healthy Minds Program.
So app, just which is go to the free. Go to the app. I mean, go to the App Store and just Healthy Minds. Okay. So we'll have that in the show notes as well. But please do take advantage. I mean, Mingyur Rinpoche does quite a bit of online stuff, and he's starting to do retreats, although they're all in the middle of nowhere in California. Why?
Someday we'll definitely go there. But there's, as you said, there's Mingyur Rinpoche teaches. We have lots of online programs and online retreats, and he's teaching online all the time. So it's pretty easy. And in addition to the in-person retreats he leads, there's a lot happening online.
Yeah, definitely take advantage. I mean, he is special. And the book, we should put a link to, In Love with the World. It's that story of him escaping the dignified abbot scene into the lowly sadhu. I mean, it's just an amazing story.
It's a great story. Really. That's a great book and great story.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Really appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you, Roger.
And everything that you're doing there. It's really wonderful work. And this is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. And there's a plethora of incredible beings, from Ram Dass and Alan Watts to Krishna Dass and Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg and on. So take advantage, and we shall see you next week. Thank you.